I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The economic crisis has left many not-for-profit organizations in a financial pinch. But a new fund run by our guest, Robin Hackey, is bringing investment into low-income neighborhoods. We'll talk with Robin of Living Cities about the Catalyst Fund and why the organization is providing loans, not grants, to rebuild challenged neighborhoods. All over the world, trains whisk people from location to location at speeds more than 100 miles an hour. Everywhere but America, that is. Rick Harnish is looking to change that, and he joins us to talk about how to connect a region using very fast trains. All that plus our City Views commentator Walker Smith and the latest news from PlanetiZen coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Our next guest has had a fruitful career as a venture capitalist and entrepreneur, and she's now applying her market smarts to the world of social investment. Robin Hackey is the Director of Capital Formation for Living Cities, a nationwide community development initiative, and she runs the new Catalyst Fund. The fund is a pool of patient, flexible capital directed specifically toward investment in not-for-profit organizations that create opportunity and make markets work better for low-income residents of America's cities. How do we know, Robin, where the most distress is occurring today in America's neighborhoods?
Well, there are a number of measures that we can use, unfortunately, to measure distress. So some of them have to do with rates of foreclosure and vacant properties, which has really become a terrific problem over the last 2 years due to the subprime mess. But unfortunately, historically, we had plenty of other measures like achievement of schools, kids in schools, and lack of access to health care, and all the traditional social indicators that we've been looking at for a long time.
Are you seeing more distress in close-in neighborhoods versus suburbs, older industrial cities versus fast-growing cities?
Well, the problem is all over, but the manifestations of the problem are different depending on where you're talking about. So in some of the older cities, the places where it's hit hardest are the inner city neighborhoods, but there's also become kind of a donut effect where the newer suburbs have gotten hit with people who have tried to drive until they qualify for mortgages. And some of those areas have also been subject to a lot of foreclosure, a lot of fraud. And so if you look at Prince George's County around the Washington area or other newer suburban areas, they've been hit by the foreclosure mess as much as some of the inner cities. And then if you look in the Sun Belt at places like Florida and Las Vegas, it takes a different cast in those places. Nowhere is immune.
Given the alarming foreclosure rate in most American cities, do we really need to be worrying about affordable housing?
Well, we sure do, because the people who've been hit by the foreclosure mess still need a place to live. And a lot of the properties which would have been good affordable homes for these folks have been stripped. They're vacant. And in many cases in these neighborhoods, people who have not been directly affected by subprime mortgages are living next to vacant houses. They're seeing their property values destroyed. And so it kind of cycles on and hits people who really didn't do anything wrong.
Given lower prices, does this offer an opportunity for low-income people?
Well, this is really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for many of the not-for-profits and developers of affordable housing to purchase land and purchase properties at really reduced prices. The question then becomes, how do they finance those properties to maintain the affordability over time? Because with any luck, this is going to be a temporary disruption, and property values will come back in these places, but it'll take a while.
How do you reconcile the tent cities we see popping up in cities like Sacramento with the number of vacant houses that must exist in those communities?
Well, there's a mismatch, obviously, between the people in the tents and the people in the houses. Many of the folks who are homeless now have had their credit ratings destroyed. In some cases, they've been tenants of foreclosed properties who really were doing nothing wrong. They were paying their rent on time. But if the owner of the property got foreclosed, their lives are disrupted, too. So there's a matching problem.
Are there investment opportunities, real investment opportunities in low-income communities?
Well, yes, there are, and that's part of what Living Cities is doing. We're a funder collaborative of financial institutions and foundations that over the last 17 years has been investing in affordable housing across the country. And we, together with many local institutions, community foundations are really trying to make an effort to see how can we take advantage of this terrible situation to make sure that these disinvested communities get fixed over the long term.
Living Cities has started a new social investment fund called the Catalyst Fund. What is the fund's purpose?
Well, the fund's purpose is to advance the agenda of Living Cities, which is to make markets work for low-income people and low-income communities in cities across the United States. And we invest in four different areas. We invest in organizations that are working on improving public education, organizations that provide opportunities for low-income and disadvantaged communities to build assets, to build income, to create jobs. A third area is to promote health and wellness, and especially access to fresh foods, which is a problem in many of these communities. And finally, we are interested in revitalizing distressed neighborhoods and communities through community facilities, through rehabs. Any one of those areas is an appropriate target for us.
Where does the money come from for such a fund?
We have at the moment seven investors who consist of insurance companies, banks, and foundations, and we're open to new investment. Any social investor who cares about the health of these disinvested communities is welcome to invest.
What are the investors' motivations?
Well, this is a what's called a double bottom line fund, which means that investors in the fund receive both financial returns, which are 1-3% returns below what people could get at one point on other kinds of investments, although these days 1-3% is looking pretty good. And they also know that their money is creating a social impact or a social bottom line. And so this is a double bottom line investment opportunity.
When you say patient capital, what do you really mean?
Well, what it means is that we're willing to lend to borrowers that may not qualify for traditional bank debt. And we're willing to subordinate our lending to market-making institutions like banks. And so we're allowing people who wouldn't normally have access to credit to be able to qualify for senior bank debt. And so our terms are obviously more flexible and more patient than the terms that people could get in the commercial market.
Is it harder to make those kinds of investments given the problems with lending and the financial markets?
Well, we attempt to leverage senior debt, and if there's no senior debt to leverage, then it's a challenge. And obviously, bank lending has been much curtailed in the last 6 months or a year. But we are willing to do projects with tremendous reserves or with leveraging government subsidies. And sometimes when we can put together all the different funding sources, we're able to induce the banks to lend. An example for that you could take a look at would be a project that we've done in Cleveland, where there is government money at the lowest level providing guarantees. There's money from us and from two other institutions as subordinated debt. And then the top of the layer cake is actually commercial senior debt from a bank. And the bank felt comfortable because of the pad that it had from these other kinds of capital to come in. So sometimes when you structure these relatively complex financings, you can actually get the banks to lend.
How is the fund being invested?
Well, we're investing in all kinds of opportunities around the country that will promote the objectives that I mentioned before, education, health. We've committed three investments so far. It's a relatively new fund. So one in Cleveland, one in Massachusetts, one in Newark, New Jersey. We're helping to build supermarkets in neighborhoods that have not had access to supermarkets or fresh, affordable foods. We're working on foreclosure mitigation in Massachusetts and in Cleveland, and we're looking at a pipeline of about 15 other deals that we hope to make some progress on in the next few months.
Can you give me an example of how you are investing in the education part of the fund?
Well, the education part is a little tricky because some of the kinds of organizations that we want to lend to don't own real estate. The traditional kind of social investment that's been made in the education space is charter schools. And charter schools do own their buildings in many cases, and so people can lend against the real estate asset. What we're trying to do is lend to education reform organizations that have a proven track record in certain places in the country and that are looking to expand to new geographies. So Teach for America would be too big for us probably, but that's the kind of organization that does terrific work and that would do even more terrific work if they could get into new locations, and we're hoping to provide the bridge capital or the lines of credit that would allow these education reform organizations to expand.
Most investment track records have been pretty lousy lately. How do you make a judgment about a nonprofit worth investing in and one that isn't?
Well, actually, the track record of nonprofits has been much better than the track record of some commercial borrowers. If you look at a group of institutions called Community Development Financial Institutions, or CDFIs, the losses that have been experienced by those institutions have been really very small, under 2% in many cases. They've done careful underwriting, and they really look at the capacity of the borrower to pay back what they've borrowed. The track record in these kinds of loans has been really terrific.
In this environment where most portfolios are suffering, what do you expect to happen with the interest of your investors and prospective investors in the Catalyst Fund?
Well, we think it's a real opportunity. You know, generally, when you start a social investment vehicle, you're asking people to sacrifice financial return in order to achieve social impact. Given the state of the market at the moment, if people can get a pretty reliable 2 or 3% return as opposed to taking their chances in an equity market that's up and down so much every day, the social investment is looking pretty attractive.
What other kinds of investments is Living Cities focused on today?
Well, the Catalyst Fund is only one of a family of social investment vehicles that Living Cities is putting together. At the moment, we're working on a green fund, which would promote investment in businesses that are going to create green-collar jobs in cities. We're also working on creation of a local fund in the San Francisco Bay Area, which would be targeted to investors who care primarily about that geography, and it would invest side by side with the Catalyst Fund.
I want to go back to your Green Jobs Initiative. It's a term that's become very popular. It's used a lot, especially by the Obama administration. But what does it really mean, and what is Living Cities doing with it?
Well, Green Jobs, it's a pretty fluffy concept at the moment. People are still working on defining exactly what it means. But what we're defining as a green job is any job which inherently through its work promotes the curbing of carbon emissions, or recycling of materials, or in general advances environmental causes, but at the same time, the kinds of green jobs that we're interested in fight poverty and pollution at the same time. And so if somebody is a general contractor and today their assignment is to go and put in a new heating system that's more energy efficient, then even though that person's job is not green all the time, we would certainly count that as being a green job. Retrofits are full of opportunities to reduce emissions, and we think that promoting those kinds of jobs is terrific. So we would be investing in contractors. There's a new industry of deconstruction, which is happening in places like Cleveland and Detroit, where they take apart houses in ways that don't generate so much landfill. And the folks who do that work, we think, are doing green jobs. Anybody who is working on new sources of energy, we think those qualify as green jobs. So there's really a wide range of professions and occupations that would count.
So how do you identify organizations that you're going to work with?
Well, we have a number of sources. First of all, our members, which are foundations, banks, and insurance companies, have deal flow in their areas where they think the organization is doing path-breaking work, and they tend to refer us deals. We also hear from mayors and municipal officials in the cities that we're active in, when they learn about opportunities that need funding. We also go out and do prospecting on our own. So, for example, in the green jobs area, we're talking to some new green banks. We're talking to the green coordinators for existing banks and really trying to identify who's doing the path-breaking work that we would like to support.
How would people make loans instead of grants?
Because social investing sometimes makes people scratch their heads and say, well, you know, if a charity needs money, why shouldn't I just give them a grant? And our perspective on that is grants are terrific, but loans serve a different purpose. They help organizations build their creditworthiness and their track record so that they can qualify for traditional debt over time. And the money comes back, recycles to the person who lent it, and so they can use it more than once. And that's obviously in this environment tremendously important. And then it creates a different kind of relationship between the lender and the borrower. Grantees sometimes feel like the grantor just sort of makes a grant and goes away or bothers them with reporting. And here there's a real partnership between the lender and the borrower to achieve, you know, a bigger purpose. It's really clear that if we use all the philanthropic dollars in the United States we're not going to solve some of the social problems that we're trying to tackle. The amounts of money that you can channel when you're using traditional forms of debt are obviously much, much bigger. And we think that the problems need that kind of capital.
How do you make a judgment about whether a neighborhood is worth investing in?
Well, it's a tough issue. Part of what we look for is local capacity, a not-for-profit organization or civic leadership that really cares about the neighborhood and has the ability to take the money and do something really useful with it. And there are plenty of places across the country that have that kind of capacity, whether it's in the form of a community development corporation or, as I mentioned before, a community development financial institution, a CDFI, or civic organizations, business organizations. What we're really looking for are the people on the ground who will take the money and make it work.
I know the fund is new and really just taking off, but what are some recent successes that these funds have seen?
Well, Living Cities has been around for a long time, and so the money that's been invested through grants and loans that Living Cities has made over the last 17 years, which amounts to about $550 million, has leveraged close to $17 billion of total investment, and that's a real success. To be able to be that kind of catalytic capital is really important to us. We also recently have done grants to foreclosure mitigation programs in 10 different cities across the country. We made those grants almost a year ago, and many of the organizations that we chose for the grants have become the designees for the neighborhood stabilization money that's now being released by the federal government. And so by helping those organizations build capacity last year, we're allowing them to make the best use of the federal funds, which are so much bigger this year.
Robin, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Okay, my pleasure.
Robin Hackey is the Director of Capital Formation for Living Cities, and she runs the Catalyst Fund. She joined us from her office in Washington, D.C. For the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn once again to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
Vacant buildings are becoming an emblem of the times. The bust of the housing market, the subprime mortgage fiasco, the resulting foreclosure explosion, and the global economic recession have caused a lot of people, businesses, and banks to simply walk away from their buildings. Recent counts from 35 of America's big cities show increases in homelessness, according to USA Today. Cities like Phoenix, LA, and Chicago saw big jumps in the number of homeless when they conducted citywide counts in February. But the problem's not just in cities. Some suburbs are also seeing major increases this year, the first nationwide homeless count conducted since 2007. For example, Seattle area officials reported a more than 40% increase in homelessness in suburban areas, due in no small part to the growing number of foreclosures. But foreclosures are not just a problem for former homeowners. Now even banks are walking away from these properties as the costs of pursuing the foreclosure process are becoming too expensive. The New York Times reported recently that more and more banks in cities across the country are refusing to take possession of troubled properties at the end of the foreclosure process. Legal fees, maintenance costs, and even demolition are often more expensive than the homes themselves, so banks are taking the economical and easy way out and simply walking away. This has turned out to be a big problem for foreclosed homeowners, who are now saddled with the extra cost of maintaining or demolishing their now worthless homes. Though there aren't any hard numbers on just how many foreclosed properties have been abandoned by banks, many experts in the field are calling this the next wave of the housing crisis. And all these abandoned homes are becoming a big problem for cities as well. Boarded up windows and unkempt properties have many city officials worried about an increase in crime and looting. In order to fight back, officials in Texas are stepping up efforts to get owners back into these abandoned buildings. The city of Fort Worth is reviving an old plan to more actively control abandoned properties. The city of Arlington has been billing property owners for the price of inspections to make sure abandoned properties aren't falling apart. And a new bill moving forward at the state level would fine any property owner that doesn't register vacant buildings or hold insurance. There's even a move to require that the plywood used to cover any windows or doors be painted to match the color of the vacant building. Though these efforts seek to reduce the damage these vacant buildings could possibly cause, cities are still going to be left with a fleet of empty spaces. But depending on how you look at them, those empty spaces might not be such a bad thing. The city of Detroit, for example, has been overwhelmed by empty and abandoned properties, but now officials there are seeing the emptiness as an opportunity. According to a recent article in Time, more than one-third of the city is empty, and economic development officials are looking at the missing teeth of empty properties as a chance to downsize the city to a more reasonable size. It was once the fourth biggest city in the U.S., but nobody there thinks it's ever going to get close to that type of population again. So instead of holding on to empty properties in hopes of a dramatic rebound, planners and officials are cutting them loose, favoring open space and parks. Experts say there is a lot of opportunity for infill development in the city core, but they also predict we'll see a much smaller Detroit in the future. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after a short break, we'll find out about the blazingly fast trains of Europe and Asia and the economic benefit of high-speed rail. Rick Harnish of the Midwest High-Speed Rail Association is my guest. I'm Carol Coletta. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online, and now back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Rail travel has always had a romantic quality in the U.S., but it's not often thought of as the most efficient way to get around. My guest, Rick Harnish, is looking to change that. He runs the Midwest High-Speed Rail Organization, a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to developing fast, frequent, and dependable passenger trains that link the entire Midwest. What is so special, Rick, about high-speed rail?
Well, high-speed rail does a lot of things all at once. It brings cities closer together so that the people within those cities can work more closely together. It reduces costs for trips that are happening today, but it also makes a lot more trips possible so that people can actually work closer together, which means that we're having more innovation, which means that we have a more productive economy.
What does high-speed rail do that nothing else can?
Well, it carries a lot more people than airplanes and cars. It does it for a lower cost. And when done right, is actually faster than both driving and flying.
Well, that sounds like a terrific proposition. Explain what constitutes high-speed rail. What is it?
Well, it's a wide range of train services. Depending upon who you talk to, you'd have a wide variety of definitions. But it's anything from the 90-mile-an-hour service that's linking Chicago to Kansas City, and because of that, it's faster to take the train to Kansas City than it is to drive, all the way up to the 220-mile-an-hour trains that make city pairs like Chicago to Minneapolis just 2.5 hours apart.
What is the outlook for high-speed rail in the U.S.?
Well, the outlook for high-speed rail is very, very good. The President of the United States has made it clear on a regular basis over the last month that he wants to see high-speed rail in the Midwest. And that's incredibly exciting. Finally, we have a president that understands what high-speed rail can do, both for individuals, for companies, and for the economy at large.
What got him interested in high-speed rail?
You know, I don't know. Having never asked the president himself specifically what got him into it, I can't say. But, you know, this is the first time we've had a president from a major city in decades. And that means that they understand the issues involved with cities much more closely than previous administrations have.
Does high-speed rail exist anywhere in the U.S.?
Well, not in the way that most people would define high-speed rail. So we do have a very good corridor service between Washington, D.C. and New York that has over 50% of the common carrier market. But we don't have what we're getting up above 10 countries around the world have, which is trains going 200 miles an hour.
And those 10 countries include which ones?
Spain, France, Britain, Brussels, Italy, Germany, China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan.
How did we get left off of that list for so long?
Well, we got left off the list because we've made a lot of small decisions, probably since World War II, that sent us in a very different direction. And it's frustrating to know that we were the first country to develop high-speed trains. We were the first country to actually build a production train set that was capable of going faster than 150 miles an hour. Up until the late 60s, we were leaders in a lot of key areas, but we really got left behind.
And we simply never deployed that technology in the U.S.?
Correct. So, you know, in 1968, with a federal grant, a couple companies got together to build the world's first true high-speed train. It was built here in Chicago. But we never built the track that it would have allowed it to really show what it could have done. And so it just wasn't deployed properly.
Explain the track situation. In other words, you can't run high-speed rail on existing tracks, correct?
Correct. So
do you upgrade tracks or do you put new tracks down?
Well, it's going to be a combination of both. So the first phases of this will be using the existing rights of way and keeping the existing highway grade crossings. And the fastest you can do upgrading the existing rights of way is about 100, 110 miles an hour. If we want to go faster than that, then we've got to start dealing with the issues of how do we eliminate highway grade crossings, and that's going to take a lot more work and a lot more time to make it happen.
So is your vision that we take this phase one step and simply use the existing rights of way and cross at grade and go the 110 miles per hour?
Absolutely. So right now it's about 5.5 hours, a little bit more than 5.5 hours between Chicago and St. Louis today. And Amtrak does that five times a day. Senator Durbin, and we're really excited about Senator Durbin making this commitment. Senator Durbin has committed to get that down to 4 hours by upgrading the existing tracks between Chicago and St. Louis. And that's an excellent first step, and we're really excited that the senator and the governor have committed to making that happen.
I know that you made a trip in January to Spain with a group of people as part of the Midwest High-Speed Rail Association to ride that nation's high-speed rail. Describe the experience.
A group of our members this past January took a trip to Spain. And there's a couple experiences that we had that were really, really kind of describe what this is about. So originally we had left one of the days open for people to do tourism on their own in Madrid. And because we wanted to take a specific train, the only way to do that was to take a trip to Seville. So at the last minute, we decided to get on the train to Seville. We caught a 7 a.m. train. We were on the ground in Seville, ready to be tourists at 9:30 in the morning. We had a good day there. We had a good lunch. We got to see all the key sites in Seville. And we took a train back. A number of us took naps on the way back. We were back in Madrid in time to have dinner with our hosts. Madrid and Seville are the distance of Chicago and St. Louis. It takes 2 hours and 20 minutes by train over there. And it really gives you a full day. Another really cool experience is we took the nonstop Madrid to Barcelona train, leaving Madrid at 8 a.m. Now, they've got today, between Madrid and Barcelona, they've got 34 daily departures, which doesn't even approach what we've got on air service on any corridors in the Midwest. You know, the train was full. It was about the equivalent of, in size, of three Southwest jets, and the plane was full. And we made the trip in 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's about the distance of Chicago to Minneapolis. We did it in 2 hours and 40 minutes. But the best thing was I have this picture of three guys in expensive suits. They're standing in the bar car talking. And one of them is standing without holding on to anything. We're going 186 miles an hour, and these guys are just standing there having a conversation like they're in a bar anywhere. So, you know, it just really is a very different experience than anything that we have here in the U.S.
Rick, let's compare those experiences. You talk about getting the Chicago to St. Louis trip down from a current 5.5 hours to 4 hours. But if that still is not short enough to let me commute on a daily basis, whereas the Madrid to Barcelona, 2.5 hours, you know, you're getting close to a daily commute there. Is there some tipping point where if we don't go this fast, if we can't make the trip in this amount of time, it really doesn't get us the economic benefits we're looking for?
We will definitely get much higher economic benefits at the 4 hours for a number of reasons. One is that it really, the people who are driving today between Chicago and St. Louis will be able to switch to the train, and that will result in a huge cost savings throughout the economy. So that's one benefit. The other benefit is that at 110 miles an hour, there's 7 or 8 towns in between that basically now have what I would call super commuter rail, so that you could live in Lincoln, Illinois, and work in any of the cities along the route. And that's a huge benefit for the entire state of Illinois. And then also it'll allow us to have faster and more frequent freight trains, which we desperately need. So we will get huge economic benefits by upgrading the existing right-of-way. But to truly integrate the economies of St. Louis and Chicago, you have to make it possible to productively do a day trip. And somewhere between 2.5 hours and 3 hours is the point at which you can leave home at a reasonable hour, let's say 6 or 7 a.m., do a full productive day of business, and be home in time to have a late dinner with your family. That's when really exciting things start to happen between those cities, and the companies that are in those two cities can truly start to integrate.
Do you really see the rejuvenation of smaller towns along the route? You mentioned Lincoln as an example.
Does this seem possible to have
rejuvenation of smaller towns along the route, along the high-speed route?
Oh, absolutely. If we get these trains to 110, towns like Lincoln and Pontiac and Dwight and Carlinville will see huge economic benefits. As the price of gasoline again goes up, it'll make it possible for people to now move back downtown into these little cities and then still be connected to the rest of the economy. It's absolutely essential for these towns that we get them linked up this way.
Did you see that in Spain?
Yeah. There were a couple of cities that were dramatic differences. Ciudad Real was one. It's a college town, kind of like Bloomington, Illinois. And they're about the same distance, Bloomington and Ciudad Real, from their major cities. There's a 155-mile-an-hour commuter train that links Ciudad Real to Madrid, and that's seen a huge resurgence in their downtown economy because of that. The town of Portiñano was basically Gary, Illinois, before the high-speed train. In fact, when you're pulling into the station, you can see the ruins of all the factories there. And now, again, they're a commuter city for Madrid.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rick Harnish from the Midwest High-Speed Rail Association. Can you give me some idea of the cost of high-speed rail to the public versus, say, an airport? Is there any way to, and highway, is there any way to compare these?
Well, it's incredibly difficult. In the mid-90s, there were a number of studies done of subsidies going to highway users. And at that point, in the mid-90s, the studies came in at $400 to $700 billion per year of subsidies going to automobile users. That's a pretty big number, and we know that it's gone up dramatically since then. Last year, the federal government put $8 billion directly into the Highway Trust Fund. so that highway projects didn't have to stop just as we were going into a presidential election. And people have raised gas taxes to pay for highways. So we know that that number is a lot bigger. We've also got the same kind of subsidies going into airports. And the comparable advantage that you get of building railroad infrastructure versus highway infrastructure is huge. One railroad lane is about the size of one highway lane, and it can handle 10 times as many people as a highway lane
can. Ah, so that's one interesting comparison, for sure.
Yes.
In terms of simply availability of land, which many people will say, if you're trying to make land available in developed areas, it's increasingly difficult to find it.
Well, one thing to kind of point out is that the key area in this is Chicago. There are people within a 500-mile radius who need to drive to Chicago because we aren't giving them a better way. And they're forced to deal with highway congestion on all of our expressways. Now, all of these expressways have been above capacity since the early 70s. And they've all been completely reconstructed since the early 70s. And it was just so expensive to expand those highways that we decided not to do it. So all we know is that it's so incredibly expensive to expand highway capacity into crucial areas that we decided not to do it because we just can't afford it. So the only way to add capacity is, in fact, by expanding the railroads.
You know this. A number of people look at the cost of high-speed rail and think they would much rather have that money to spend on local transit systems. What's your response to that?
Well, that's funny because the city of Lyon in France, so the first European true high-speed rail line in Europe was between Paris and Lyon. And by coincidence, again, that's about the same distance as Chicago to St. Louis or Chicago to Detroit. Lyon actually came out against the TGV because they wanted to build a subway network. And fortunately, they lost that battle because now Lyon is a completely different city because of the high-speed train. You know, now people, you know, Lyon has excellent restaurants, even by Paris standards, and so people take the train down to Lyon for lunch and back. So not only did Lyon get their high-speed rail line, but they also got their subway. They've just put in a new streetcar network because of the economic impacts that happened because the train is there. And now, plus, you're leaving all these people in town without a car, and they have to get around. And the best way for them to get around is on the transit network. So they're interdependent upon each other, and we should be doing both. And given the desperate problems that we have with oil supply, we should be doing this incredibly quickly.
Let me go back to something you said earlier, just make sure I understand. Are you saying that freight uses the same corridor and the same tracks as high-speed rail?
Somewhere around 90 miles an hour is the breakpoint where you can effectively share freight tracks and passenger tracks if both of them are very busy. If you've got a busy passenger line, you can put an occasional freight train on it. If you've got a busy freight line, you can put an occasional passenger train on it. And right around 90 miles an hour is the breakpoint.
Meaning 90 miles an hour, explain the breakpoint to me.
Well, it's actually somewhere between 90 and 110, depending upon the specific examples. But that's where, if you want to go faster than 110 miles an hour,
you can't share.
You can't share.
Got it. So, you know, long term, are we looking at double corridors?
In the long term, absolutely, yes.
Okay. Are there places where high-speed rail makes sense and not in other places?
Well, the list of where it makes sense in this country is so long that it would take a long time to do it.
But, well, let me ask it differently. Are there lines, are there places in the country that should have priority?
Yes, there absolutely are. The California network should have very high priority. And also kind of a Y shape with one of the ends of the Y at St. Paul, another one at St. Louis. Now, this is true high-speed rail, just so we're clear, where we're building completely a new track and running trains at 220. So kind of a Y shape, St. Paul and St. Louis being on the ends of the Y, coming into Chicago, and then going east from Chicago with a branch down to Indianapolis and then down to Cincinnati, a branch over to Detroit and then Toledo and then Cleveland and then Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Philadelphia. That is an absolutely critical link that needs to be made.
So connecting up really the Midwest to ultimately to the East.
Absolutely.
And then of course, you haven't mentioned the East Coast, which I presume also is ripe for high-speed rail.
Yeah, and there's dramatic improvements you could make on the existing right-of-way between New York and Washington, D.C. that could cut that travel time down even further. And going up to Boston and then up to Albany, down to Richmond, and then from there, keep extending it, you know, southwest to Atlanta. You know, and then when you include 90-mile-an-hour trains, basically the map should probably look like the interstate highway map.
Mm-hmm. Is high-speed rail getting any stimulus money?
Yeah. So because of the president's direct intervention, there is an $8 billion allocation out of stimulus money for high-speed rail.
And who will decide where that money gets spent?
The Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood.
Mm-hmm. And just to confirm, there is no line from Disneyland to Las Vegas in the stimulus package. Fair to say?
There were no specific projects designated in the stimulus package, yes.
Tell me where the component parts are now made of high-speed rail. Are we manufacturing any of that in the U.S.?
Actually, we are. Timken.
Really? Even though there's no market for it yet?
Right. Timken in Ohio makes the bearings for the TGVs.
Okay. Bearings. Sounds like a tiny part of this. Or is that a big part? I don't know.
Well, that's a pretty critical part. So the wheel rests on the bearing, and then if the bearing doesn't function properly, the wheel doesn't turn properly. And so,
can we change that? Can we make more of, is there a possibility that we would manufacture more of these parts in America?
Well, you know, China did not have a high-speed train industry just probably 5 or 6 years ago, and now they do. So it's certainly possible to build this industry up very quickly.
Is there an opportunity? Surely the conversation has been held. What do we do with the abundance of automobile manufacturers and plants and parts and manufacturers that are now sitting empty? Any chance that they would be converted?
Well, I certainly hope that the existing auto manufacturers would be converted, or some of the existing manufacturing capability for automobile certainly should be converted for building high-speed trains.
Rick, what's next? You got the stimulus package. I know that was a big win for you. What's next for you?
The next step is making sure that the progress continues in the 2010 appropriation at the federal level, getting governors throughout the Midwest to make this one of their number one priorities. And we're going to be deciding what our transportation priorities are in a more long-term sense this year as part of the highway bill reauthorization. And so people need to be telling their elected leaders, both at the state levels and at the federal levels, that they want high-quality trains linking the entire Midwest.
Rick, good luck with your work. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much.
Rick Harnish is the executive director of the Midwest High Speed Rail Association. To find out more about the organization and how you can help lay rails in your region, we have a link to his site on ours, smartcityradio.com. Finally, this week, even the most sensible among us are seeing dark clouds on the horizon. Leave it to Walker Smith, our City Views commentator, to see that reports of the death of optimism have been greatly exaggerated.
The dystopians are in full throat these days. It's not Malthus or Paul Ehrlich or the Club of Rome or Y2K these days. Instead, it's peak oil, peak carbon, peak money, peak fish, peak dirt, Back to the Land, Off the Grid, The Second Vermont Republic, Dmitry Orlov, James Kunstler, Jim Sinclair, Gerald Celente, and Nassim Taleb. Oh, yes, and don't forget Nouriel Roubini, who is the world's new oracle of choice because of his dead-on predictions of the current financial crisis, now speaks Cassandra-like to a willing opt-in global audience in a daily series of dark emails. It's even David Brooks, the highly sensible and usually balanced conservative columnist for the New York Times, who warned rich Republicans in a recent column that the coming era of so-called Ward III Democratic rule would turn hedge fund masters of the universe into namby-pamby masters of grovel. He calls it Ward III because this is the name of an area in Washington, D.C., where many Democratic staffers live. I feel firmly that this chorus of dystopia is nonsense, all of it. Yes, we have a crisis on our hands, but things always tend towards equilibrium, not catastrophe. That's why everyday life is so humdrum. Sometimes catastrophes happen, but mostly they happen only when we let them happen. And even when the worst happens, after it's all over, we are like the traders at what's now left of Lehman Brothers, as described in a recent story in the Wall Street Journal. These traders are going about their jobs as always, while the firm works out its bankruptcy. In other words, after Lehman's September 15th crash, it's back to business as usual. Equilibrium, not some version of Cormac McCarthy's post-apocalyptic novel that was made into a movie called The Road, is the path on which we generally find ourselves. There is no worldwide collapse looming, not unless we do it to ourselves, which seems to be exactly what we're intent on doing right now. The media and internet echo chamber is at maximum amplification nowadays, and it's terrifying people into paralysis and despair. Lucy Kellaway, a management and business columnist for the Financial Times, offered a useful reminder for all of us when she said recently that we should turn off the news and quit tracking the Dow minute by minute. It's time to do what President Obama urged of us in his inaugural address. Quote, pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. If we give ourselves over to visions of dystopia, we will give rise to a self-fulfilling prophecy. Changing the future is as simple as, and yes, as hard as, changing the assumptions that go into all of these dire extrapolations. And we do this by dusting ourselves off and doing something about them. The choice of our future is up to us. So I say, choose optimism and prove the dystopians wrong. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. You can get more information about our guests and their work online by going to our website, smartcityradio.com. You can also download past shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, and subscribe to our podcast. You can also get in touch with us. Click on the contact button or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Let us know how we're doing. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our increasingly repetitive producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.